Okay, so the main reason I'm interested in non-contextuality is I think it provides one of our best notions of how quantum theory and the world differ from the classical conception of reality. So I want to start just by saying what I feel are some good desiderata for what a notion of non-classicality should satisfy. So first of all, I think it's important that it's applicable to a wide range of physical scenarios. So in a sense, we're lacking a unified notion of non-classicality currently in quantum physics. If you go to different areas of quantum physics, like quantum optics or quantum field theory, you'll find different notions of what quantum classical correspondence is, what the classical limit is. It might be in terms of Feynman path integrals or Wigner representations, or in terms of all your operators being diagonal on the same basis. But it's not unified. So it would be nice to have a notion that was sort of abstract. It wasn't particular to particles or fields or discrete systems, but it covered all of them. Secondly, the experience in quantum information theory has been when you do have experiments that don't satisfy classical principles, you can often do something interesting, right? So quantum mechanics provides new opportunities for information processing, communication, computation, things like that. So we want our notion of non-classicality to somehow explain the fact that deviations from those classical principles constitute a resource. And then finally, and I think perhaps the most important one, is that it'd be nice if our notion of non-classicality could be subjected to a direct experimental test. So what I mean by that is it should be phrased in a completely operational way such that you can go to the lab and do an experiment and ask, does the principle of classicality hold in this experiment or does it fail? And what's so important about that is that it basically creates a boundary between certain classical principles holding and them not. And if you do go to the lab and say, okay, these classical principles fail, then that doesn't just show you that quantum theory must fail to satisfy these classical principles, but it means every future physical theory that we have is going to be non-classical in that same way. And that's what's really distinctive about experiments in quantum foundations. They're really constraints on the possible constructions of theories in the future. And so that's why I think it's so critical to have such a notion. So one of our best notions to date of non-classicality is when your operational theory or experiment fails to admit of John Bell's notion of local causality. So this certainly does admit of direct experimental tests. That's what Bell inequalities do. There's also been a lot of work in recent years showing that it's a resource. So you can do device-independent key distribution with Bell inequality violations. You can do device-independent randomness generation, things like that. But where it fails us is in terms of its breadth. So if I look at an experiment that I would use to test Bell inequalities, I prepare a pair of particles, I do some sets of measurements on the two wings, and those measurements have to be done at space-like separation. And if you ask, think about the set of quantum experiments that we typically think resist classical explanation, are they all of this sort? No, almost none of them are. That space-like separation is just not a feature of generic experiments. If I go to condensed matter or any experiment you like, it's just not of that form. Okay, so what about the failure to admit of a non-contextual model? So where it really has an edge is on this breadth. So if I look at the kind of experiment for which we could ask, is there a non-contextual model? It's just some preparation with some measurement device at the end, possibly some transformation in the middle, but there's no need for space-like separation, and pretty much every experiment in physics fits that form. So I can ask of any given experiment, does it admit of a non-contextual model? And in particular, the Bell experiment is a special case of this, where the measurement happens to be the space-like separation. And in fact, local causality can be thought of as a kind of non-contextuality. So we have that breadth, but the question is, do we have these other desiderata? So what we're going to hear about in this conference on Wednesday and Thursday is a lot of nice work on how, in fact, certain notions of contextuality do constitute a resource for cryptography and computation and communication protocols. And so then the question just becomes, can you subject it to a direct experimental test? And that's traditionally, I think, what the sticking point has been. So, the second contextuality war that Adan was talking about was a question of whether, finite precision makes it impossible to do a direct experimental test of non-contextuality. I've had sort of traditionally a skepticism about this, but the first part of this talk is going to be to try to explain how I think we can do this. We can subject it to direct experimental test if we define it in a certain way. And so I think because you can have check marks across the board, that makes non-contextuality really our best notion of non-classicality. And therefore, it's a really critical component of quantum theory and of future physical theories as well. Okay, so what's the my preferred approach to defining the principle? And I think of it, I have to tell you what an operational theory is and what an ontological model is to define it. So an operational theory is just a very minimalist description of a physical theory, which just posits that there are preparation procedures described as lists of instructions of what you should do in the lab. There are measurement procedures, which are distinguished by having some classical outcome. And all the theory does is it tells you what the probability distribution over the outcomes are for a given measurement and for a given preparation. So you just specify the preparation measurement. The theory provides an algorithm for computing statistics. An ontological model, it is a way of trying to explain those statistics that you observe in the lab. So it basically posits that when you do this kind of preparation here, you're actually generating a system that has some physical properties. And it's those physical properties that then cause the measurement device to respond in a particular way. And so in particular, if I'm going to refer to the complete set of physical properties of that system as the ontic state of the system. So any ontological model posits a space of possible ontic states, and I'll denote a particular ontic state by lambda. And the role of this thing is to be a causal mediary between the preparation and the measurement. So it's what, as I said, causally determines the distribution of our outcomes of the measurement. So in particular, if I want to describe an ontological model of some particular operational theory, then for every preparation procedure in the theory, I specify a distribution of our ontic states. So think of this distribution as if I were to do that preparation, then the ontic state of the system will be sampled at random from this distribution. Okay, so it doesn't fix the ontic state necessarily. The ontic state, the most general possibility is that the ontic state is sampled randomly. And similarly, a measurement then generates an outcome depending on the ontic state of the system that's fed into it. So it could, for example, just generate an outcome depending on sort of what part of the ontic state space the ontic state was in. But it could also generate an outcome indeterministically. So this is the most general possibility. So for example, over here, if I have this value of lambda, then I'll definitely get the first outcome of this three outcome measurement. But if I'm over here, then there's some probability of getting the first outcome, some probability of getting the second outcome. And you can think of that indeterminism either as objective indeterminism, or you could say, oh, well, there's some other degrees of freedom inside the measurement apparatus that do determine it uniquely, but the ontic state of the system that came from the preparation device is not determining it uniquely. Okay, and then it's only an ontological model of your theory if you can reproduce the predictions of your theory in that model, so that you write down the probability of the outcome given the ontic state times the probability of the ontic state for that preparation, you sum over the ontic states, and you need to get back the statistics of the operational theory. Okay, so with those definitions, I can now tell you what my preferred notion of non-contextuality is. It's basically an inference from features of the operational theory to features of the ontological model. And roughly speaking, if I have two experimental procedures that are operationally equivalent, in a sense I'll make precise in a moment, then they should be represented equivalently in the ontological model. That's the idea. And this is the paper where it was first proposed. So I'm going to tell you about what that notion of operational equivalence is, and I'm going to start with preparation procedures. So in this notion of non-contextuality, it applies not just to measurement procedures, but to preparation procedures as well. And it's slightly easier to see it in this case. So say you've got an operational theory, and it says, look, there's lots of ways you can prepare a system. So here's a whole battery of possible preparations you can do on your system, and there's a whole bunch of measurements you can do on that same system. Even with that bare-bone structure, you can start to find interesting things. You can define an equivalence relation among the preparation procedures. So I can take, for example, each of these preparations and put them in front of every one of those measurements and take a lot of statistics. And so I can say for P1, what are the statistics on all the measurements I can do on the system? Similarly for P4. And if I find that the statistics for every measurement is the same on the two, I say they're operationally equivalent. It means, you know, they make exactly the same predictions for all measurements. There might be differences in the detail of what's going on in these boxes, but for the purposes of, you know, what they're going to mean for measurements downstream, those details make no difference. And so I can sort all the preparation procedures into equivalence classes. Here's the technical definition, just that for all measurements, the distribution over outcomes of the measurement is the same for P as it is for P prime. And I'll denote that equivalence relation by this symbol. Okay, so let's take maybe some terminology. The differences between these circled areas are the differences of equivalence class, and any remaining differences, so these are differences in the details of how you've done a particular preparation, I'm going to call those differences of context. So a context is something in addition to a specification of the equivalence class. So some examples are useful. If we go to the operational theory, quantum theory, as opposed to some more general possibility, then the equivalence classes are just different density operators, because any two different density operators always predict some different statistics for some measurement. But there are other differences, which are really differences of preparation context. So for example, if you know this device prepares the zero or the one state of a qubit with equal probability, and this one prepares the plus or the minus state with equal probability, but you don't get to look inside the box, both of them are generating the completely mixed state, and no measurement can tell those two things apart. So those sorts of differences, there's really different things going inside these two boxes because they're different ensembles. Nonetheless, we're going to call that a difference of preparation context. Okay, so what is a preparation non-contextual model? It's one that assigns the same distribution over ontic states for all the procedures in an equivalence class. So it's a model that says the reason you can't see any difference in the measurement statistics on these two preparation procedures is because they're really just sampling from the same distribution of ontic states. So of course, nothing you do is going to see the difference because they're really described in exactly the same way in the ontological model. A preparation contextual model is one of this sort. It represents these two preparations that differ only in context by different distributions in the model. So that's a logically consistent possibility. It could be that none of these measurements are fine-grained enough to see the difference between those two distributions. But it's a rather peculiar thing that even though I'm doing every measurement conceivable, there are differences between those distributions that I nonetheless can't reveal in the statistics of those measurements. So that's the sense in which preparation non-contextuality seems a very natural assumption to make a priori. And so, you know, it's interesting to consider whether we can have it. The definition of measurement non-contextuality is analogous, but for measurements. You can sort your measurement devices into equivalence classes. Two measurements are operationally equivalent if they gave the same statistics for all preparation procedures. And now, any remaining differences in how I implement two measurements that are operational equivalent, I call a difference of context. So here's a quantum example. If I do this basis of a three-dimensional system and then I coarse grain the psi 2 and psi 3 outcomes, or if I do this other basis with psi 2 prime and psi 3 prime, but psi 1 in common, and then I coarse grain these two outcomes, they're both measurements of the same observable in quantum mechanics. It's just psi 1 versus the two-dimensional subspace that's orthogonal to it. It's just that the way I decompose that two-dimensional subspace is different in the two cases, but that makes no difference to the statistics of those two measurements on any preparation procedure. So the idea of a measurement non-contextual model is that we explain the fact that all these measurements in a given class give the same statistics by the fact that in the model they're monitoring exactly the same properties. So they're responding to the ontic state that's fed into them in exactly the same way. And a measurement contextual model is one wherein they respond differently. And this is a logically consistent possibility, but it means that you know these battery of preparations must be such that in the ontological model, they're represented by distributions that don't form a basis for the space of functions. They can't resolve these two types of response functions. So that seems like a less natural explanation than the one that just posits measurement non-contextuality. Okay, so just to summarize, the preparation non-contextuality is an inference from operational equivalence of preparations to them being represented by the same distributions over the ontic states, and measurement non-contextuality is the inference from operational equivalence of measurements to them being represented by the same response functions in the ontological model. And the idea is that the best explanation of the fact that there's no context dependence at the operational level is the fact that there's no context dependence at the ontological level. Okay, there's a similar notion for transformations, which I'm not going to go into. And then I want to say that the only really natural assumption is that you assume non-contextuality for all your procedures, which I call universal non-contextuality, because you can give the same reasons for thinking that preparation non-contextuality is natural as thinking that measurement non-contextuality is natural. I don't think it makes sense to just assume one without the others. Okay, so now I want to compare this approach to other approaches, and in particular, the one that Adan described in the last talk. So as I see it, other approaches agree that to assume non-contextuality is to assume an inference of the form, some equivalence relation holding between two experimental procedures, therefore equivalent representations in the ontological model. But I think that the alternative approaches focus on measurements, so that they don't speak about what it would mean to have a non-contextual representation of preparations or transformations. And they disagree on the nature of the equivalence relation over on the left and on the nature of the ontological representation on the right. So let's consider the first disagreement. So the nature of the equivalence relation between measurement procedures. So this is a quote from one of Adan's papers from a few years back. And so we're imagining here a measurement of A, which is compatible with B and compatible with C, but B and C are not compatible with one another. And the idea is this: if the experimental apparatus used for measuring A must be the same when it's measured together with B and when it is measured together with C. Those are the grounds for representing A the same way, in Adan's case, assigning it the same value. And it was a slightly different example in the paper, but I made it generic for A, B, and C here. So I want to argue that this sameness of the apparatus is neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for representing these two measurements equivalently. So the reason I think it's not a necessary condition is that there are many cases in which the details of the apparatus are in fact radically different, and yet I think we should represent them the same way in the ontological model. So for example, if I'm measuring whether the polarization of a photon is horizontal or vertical, I can do that with a piece of Polaroid, or I can do it with a birefringent crystal. These are two perfectly good ways of doing one and the same measurement. And in particular, in quantum theory, I would represent both of these things by exactly the same projector value measure, the same observable. So on the operational side, we think that they're the same in all relevant aspects. In other words, no matter what preparation I do ahead of these two devices, they're going to give me exactly the same statistics. And I think that gives me grounds for thinking that they ought to be represented ontologically the same way, in spite of these differences between how the procedures were implemented. Okay, maybe more importantly, why is the sameness of the apparatus not sufficient for representing those measurements in the same way in the ontological model? So suppose we have this sort of situation where we're considering a measurement M1, and suppose it's compatible with some measurement M2 and some measurement M3 as well, but M2 and M3 are not compatible with one another. So I imagine I measure M1 together with M2, and then I discard the outcome of the M2 measurement. Similarly here, and I discard the outcome of the M3 measurement. So you might say, okay, well, as long as the details of this local apparatus are the same, this is just measuring M1 in two different contexts, right? So we should assign it the same value in the ontological model. That's the kind of argument. But what I'm unhappy about is that it's the sort of fact that I went to the lab and I did things locally the same way doesn't guarantee that that was really achieved. So for example, if the differences between M2 and M3 create stray magnetic fields of different natures, then it could be that what's actually happening inside this device is different in the two cases because it's being preceded by different measurement devices. So the real question is, how do we know that that hasn't happened? How do we know there hasn't been stray magnetic fields? And again, I think the answer is, if you go and you do every preparation procedure that the theory allows, and you see that the statistics of these two measurements are in fact exactly the same, then you have reasons for saying, yes, there weren't differences of the stray magnetic fields, and these were the same in the relevant way. So at the end of the day, it seems to me that we should focus on operational equivalent, and that the relevant notion of sameness for two implementations of a measurement is that they should give the same statistics for all preparation procedures on the system. And let me just note that if you ask, you know, what grounds could you ever give for why two devices in your lab should be represented by the same observable in quantum theory, ultimately an experimenter would say, okay, well, let me do tomography on these two devices. Let me do a tomographically complete set of states and see if these two devices give the same statistics. And if they do, then I'll say, yes, we can represent them by the same projective value measure. And so this notion is really just a generalization of that from the quantum sphere to any operational theory. Okay, the second disagreement is about the nature of the ontological representation of the measurements. So this was how I define a measurement non-contextual model. It allowed indeterministic responses of the apparatus. This is the competing proposal, which would be that we should model these measurements by sharp response functions, meaning they only take probabilities 0 and 1. So one could call this the sort of operational generalization of the original Koshin-Specker notion of non-contextuality. So from that perspective, Koshin-Specker non-contextuality can be thought of as the notion of measurement non-contextuality I told you about, together with an assumption of outcome determinism, meaning that the outcome of a measurement is fixed deterministically by the ontic state, not probabilistically. So one of the reasons I don't like the Koshin-Specker, the generalization of Koshin-Specker to operational theories as the right notion, is that in the face of a violation of this notion of non-contextuality, you could always just give up on determinism and say, well, you know, the lesson here is that measurements don't respond deterministically. And that's not a strategy you can take in Bell's theorem. You can't salvage locality by giving up on determinism. So to my mind, it's sort of a problem if we could somehow salvage the spirit of non-contextuality by merely giving up on determinism. Secondly, you can show that if you subscribe to this notion of universal non-contextuality, then you can prove that a model assigns outcomes to a quantum measurement deterministically if and only if that measurement is sharp in quantum theory, is represented projectively. So you can find the proof in this paper. And then the point is that if we want to fulfill that desiderata I mentioned at the beginning, that this notion of non-classicality should be subjectable directly to experimental tests, then because every experiment fails to be sharp, you know, no matter how good your experiment is, it will never be modeled by projectors. It'll always be some POVM with some perhaps very small but non-vanishing amount of noise. So all measurements in every experiment are unsharp. And therefore, they are not modeled deterministically. And so we really need a notion of non-contextuality for unsharp measurements if we want to understand non-classicality in real experiments, in my view. And then let me just briefly address one of the points Adam made about a sort of in defense of deterministic representations of measurements, which was this whole Neumark dilation business. So it's certainly true, not just in quantum theory, but in general theories, that if I have a measurement on a sum system and another one here, and they're operationally equivalent, I can certainly consider each of them in quantum mechanics, for example, if they're POVMs, to in fact be projective measurements on a larger system. So not the system alone, but the system and some ancillary system which has been prepared in some way. So my notion of non-contextuality says if those measurements are operationally equivalent, then the response functions of these whole boxes should be the same, and they don't have to be deterministic. But you might say, well, but these response functions are going to be outcome deterministic, right? They're projective, first of all, in the quantum case. But even more generally, in a classical ontological model, it makes sense to say if I have an indeterministic response, I can always think of that as a deterministic response on a larger system. So I mentioned earlier that if the indeterminism in your measurement is because of some extra degrees of freedom in your measurement device that make the outcome deterministic, then I can certainly do this kind of extension in the ontological model, where these response functions for these two guys now are outcome deterministic, valued in 0, 1. But the problem is that we have no justification, even though these things are outcome deterministic, we have no justification for setting them equal to one another, because measurement non-contextuality would say that only if you could show that these two measurements were operationally equivalent, so that's MSA and M prime SA, only if those two are operation equivalent are you justified in making these. But you only know that MS and MS prime are operation equivalent, And you have really no evidence here because you haven't done a full battery of preparations on the ancilla. You've just got this one preparation here and this one preparation here. And so you really don't know whether the dilated measurements are equivalent on all preparations. And so you have no grounds for assuming equality of the outcome deterministic response functions. All you really have grounds for from this operational equivalence is that if I take that deterministic response function and I convolve it with the distribution over the ancillas in each of these cases, then those things are equal. But this is just an outcome indeterministic response function on the system alone. So we're back to the initial condition. Okay, so now I want to say, let's say you grant this and you're interested in coming up with direct experimental tests of the notion of non-contextuality. How can you do it? And there's a few challenges that have to be met. So the first challenge is, how do you derive constraints on experimental statistics from this notion of non-contextuality for preparations and measurements when they're unsharp, when or noisy? And so for many years, I didn't know how to solve this problem. And it's only recently that I think it's really clear, it's become clear how to do this. And I'll get to that in a moment. Let me just go through the other problems first. So the second problem is, how do you experimentally establish operational equivalence relations among procedures? So the first problem is that non-contextuality is an inference from an exact equivalence here to an exact equivalence there. And experimentally, if I do two preparation procedures, like my mixture of Z up and Z down and my mixture of X up and X down spin eigenstates, I never achieve perfectly the same density operator on average. I'll never get exactly the complete mixed state for one and for the other. They'll always be slightly different. So I'll never have exact equality for two preparations on all measurements, strictly speaking. So I won't have satisfied the antecedent to this inference, and non-contextuality will really imply nothing, right? If I haven't satisfied this, I get nothing out of non-contextuality because it's an inference. And the second problem is that there's a universal quantifier sitting out here. It has to be for all preparations, for all measurements. So in the lab, we don't do all possible measurements. We don't do all possible preparations. So again, how do we ever know that the antecedent to the inference is satisfied? How do we ever get anything out of the assumption of non-contextuality? Okay, so I'm going to go through each of these in turn. So the problem of contending with unsharpness. So if you're interested in this, these three papers I've listed above, the two papers on top in particular, solve this problem. And the talk by Ravi Kunjwal on Friday is going to discuss this at more length. There has now been sort of elaborations on these sorts of techniques, so we're in a better position to derive essentially all the constraints that follow when you have unsharp measurements. And so this is a recent paper with Ellie Wolf, who's here, and a former master student, Anirudh Krishna. And it's basically using the Prez-Mermin square as its illustrative example, and it provides an algorithm for deriving non-contextuality inequalities. So as not to overlap with what Ravi's saying, I'm going to say a little bit about this case, how we contend with unsharpness here. So many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Prez-Mermin square version of non-contextuality. So you've got 9 observables on a pair of qubits. They're compatible in triples, right? So the 3 on any given row are compatible. The 3 on any given column are compatible. And furthermore, they satisfy specific functional relations. So the product of any 3 on one of the rows is identity. The product of these 3 and these 3 are identity. But the product of these 3 is minus identity. So if I now say, what does the standard notion of non-contextuality say? It says I should assign outcomes to measurements of these observables deterministically. Well, when I measure this any one of these observables, I can only get the +1 or -1 outcome because those are the eigenvalues of the observable. And if I were to measure identity, I only get the +1 outcome always. So the only values that these guys can take, you know, for these, it's +1 and -1 on the bottom. For these, it's each +1 or -1. But if I just write down what the functional relations imply for all those values, I get a contradiction. There's no set of values to these 9 observables that satisfy all these relations. So there's no Cochen-Specker non-contextual model. Now, we want to operationalize this. We don't want to assume the correctness of quantum theory, right? We want to test nature and ask, can it be non-contextual or not? So we can't have any of the quantum formalism ultimately appearing in our non-contextuality inequalities. So instead, we say, suppose we just have 9 binary outcome measurements. Okay, we're going to label their outcomes plus or minus one. Now, what's the analog of saying, you know, they're compatible, say, like the first triple here? So unlike the approach that Adam spoke about, where compatibility is about doing one measurement and then doing another and seeing that it's invariant under reordering, the notion of compatibility that I like to use is a notion of joint simulatability. So if the three measurements on the first row are compatible, it means I can find a single measurement which I can post-process in three different ways and simulate exactly these three guys. So in particular, for the example we have in mind, you know, think of the quantum case, I'm measuring the x observable on qubit 1 and the x observable on qubit 2. And if I throw away the outcome of the measurement on qubit 2, I get this guy. If I throw away the outcome of the measurement on qubit 1, I get this guy. And if I take the product of the two outcomes, I get a measurement of x tensor x. So in that case, it's clear that I just need to do that measurement of x on both, either throw away the second outcome, throw away the first outcome, this ground symbol just means ignore the outcome, or take the product of the two, and I've simulated each of these guys. But I don't have to consider the quantum example. I could just say, consider any three measurements which can be simulated in this way. Then they have the same functional relation that the first row of the Perez-Merman square has. So even if the measurements are unsharp, for example, it still makes sense to imagine that they can be jointly simulated in this way. So similarly with the first column, I imagine there's a measurement that simulates all three of them. And you know, just looking at the quantum example, you know, here I'm throwing away the outcome of the measurement on the second qubit, throw away the outcome on the first qubit, here take the product. So that's exactly what we do. Take the product on the bottom one, throw the relevant guys away. And just fill in the rest of the table like that. We find, you know, these have to be operationally equivalent. If they're both going to simulate the same measurement, it means they have to give the same statistics for all preparation procedures. So the notion of measurement context here is, am I measuring this because I've measured it jointly with these guys, or have I measured it jointly with these guys? Is it this that underlies it, or this? Okay, so you fill in the rest, and you get all these simulations of the rows and the columns. They're in different colors. The only subtlety is that when I simulate the last row, the last column, I'm sorry, I take the product of the outcomes times minus one, because here I expect that the product of all three outcomes will be minus one rather than plus one. So only if the simulation looks like this do I respect the same functional relation that I had in the quantum version of Perez-Merman. So you need to go, if you want to do an experiment for Perez-Merman, you need to go to the lab and find nine measurements that are compatible in exactly this sense, right? I can simulate them all in this way. Okay, and then the functional relations that I've just described ensure that, you know, when you do these three measurements together and you get some joint distribution over the three outcomes, that joint distribution will only have support on triples of outcomes whose product is plus one. And similarly, with a joint measurement on these three guys, the distribution will only have support on triples of values whose product is plus one. And on these three guys, it's only supported on triples of values whose product is minus one. So we know they can't be point distributions, because then all of these measurements would have to have some fixed outcome, and there's no set that satisfies this inequality. But it is possible to have indeterministic assignments that satisfy exactly these relations. So here's an example. So imagine that the ontic state, when you measure these three guys together, just deterministically assigns plus one, plus one, plus one. But when you measure these three guys together, it deterministically assigns plus one to this measurement. But the outcomes of these measurements are indeterministic. It's equally likely that they're both plus or both minus. So I write that as 1 half plus 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 1 half minus minus. When I do these three together, similarly, it's definitely plus here, but it's a perfect correlation, plus plus minus minus here. Similarly with this guy, it's a perfect correlation here. And then with this guy, it's plus and perfect anti-correlation. So this is a non-contextual assignment, because when I look at the marginal response on any one measurement device, like this guy here, for example, he's responding to the ontic state by just always generating either plus or minus with equal probability. And it doesn't matter whether I'm measuring in relative to this row or to this column, he just gives equal probability for plus or minus. Okay, so there's no joint distribution that underlies these all, but it's perfectly fine in terms of matching up as indeterministic response functions everywhere that they overlap. If I look at just the expectation values of the outcomes, I see that it's, you know, pluses for five of them and zero expectation value for these four in the corner, because you know, it's equally likely to be plus one or minus one. So there are many indeterministic non-contextual assignments. This is just an example of one. Okay, so at this stage, you know, if you just went to the lab, you did these measurements, they have these compatibility relations, And you saw that, you know, they were assigned some outcomes. You know, there's no contradiction because we have lots of no contradiction with non-contextuality if we allow for indeterminism. There's lots of assignments. To get a contradiction, we need to look at the preparations. We need to assume preparation non-contextuality as well. And then we find that there's constraints on the correlations that we can see between the sources and the measurements, the preparations and the measurements. To make this intuitive, I'm just going to introduce one new concept. Instead of talking about preparations, I'm going to talk about sources. So a source is a set of preparation procedures chosen at random and which outputs as a classical variable which preparation procedure occurred. So I get this term from quantum information theory where, you know, the input of a quantum channel can be one of a set of quantum states, but you also keep a record of, you know, which quantum state was sent down the channel. So that's all a source is. So it looks a bit more like a measurement because it has an outcome now, which just registers which state is happening. Okay, and I'll use little s to denote the outcome of the source. So in particular, I'm going to be interested in the preparation that's defined by a source when you just don't register the outcome. Right, so every source defines sort of an average preparation where you're just averaging over all the procedures with the weights that you've sampled them by. And you're going to represent that in the ontological model as just, you know, your representation of the source. So the source gives you a joint distribution over the ontic state that it outputs, the classical outcome it generates. And if you just take the average, then you're just summing, you're marginalizing over the outcome of the source. And you're just getting a distribution over the ontic states. So if it happens that two different sources give me the same average preparation, then preparation non-contextuality says the overall distribution over the ontic states should be the same for those two sources. Okay, so what does this mean for Perez-Merman? Well, we just imagine a whole bunch of preparations that parallel the measurements. So for every one of these observables, these nine observables, I say, imagine the source that prepares one of the two eigenspaces of this observable. So either the mixed state onto the first eigenspace or the mixed state onto the other eigenspace with equal probability, right? For each of those nine. So we've got nine binary outcome sources, but if you ask what's the average preparation, it's just gonna be the complete mixed state in each case. If I don't know which eigenspace, it's just the complete mixed state. So they have that property that they give the same average state for all of them. They have exactly the same sorts of functional relations as we had before, which means that I can talk about compatibility of these sources. So like the three sources on the first row, there exists a source which I can post-process in three different ways to simulate each of them. Just do the four outcome source that measures x on one qubit and x on the other, and then ignore the second outcome or ignore the first outcome or take the product of the two outcomes. Now you've simulated all three of those sources. So you have a notion of compatibility for sources just like you do for measurements. It's all exactly the same. So if, you know, if these were sources, I just reproduced my drawing with the measurements, but imagine these had outputs on the right-hand side. They were all sources. This is what their compatibility relations would look like, exactly the same as for the measurements. But furthermore, we have this one extra constraint, was that when I just look at the average preparation for every one of the nine, they're all the operationally equivalent. So that's enough to get interesting constraints. So we take this, let's start with this one extra equivalence here. It tells me that the overall distribution over the ontic states is independent of which source you did. There's just some fixed distribution over the ontic states for every one of these sources when you don't look at the outcome of the source. And therefore, if I want to know what is the expression for the correlation between the outcome of a measurement and the outcome of a source when I pair them together, so this is the operational quantity, what's the expression for that quantity in the ontological model? It's just the probability of getting the outcome, little mj, given this measurement, given the ontic state lambda, times the joint probability of getting the outcome little s and the ontic state lambda for the given source. And now I just need a trick. I just do Bayesian inversion, right? So I move lambda to the right-hand side of the conditional. This is what I require for Bayesian inversion. And then I note that because of preparation non-contextuality, this thing doesn't depend on SI. That's what we had up here. So it's just some fixed distribution. And now it looks just like a very familiar formula from Bell inequality derivations. It says, I can think of this as a distribution over hidden variables, and then a conditional for the outcome of the measurement, and a conditional for the outcome of the source. And the only difference is that here, this conditional represents retrodiction. It's what learning lambda teaches you about what the outcome was previously. So I could just think of that as, you know, what can I possibly learn about the outcome of the source given lambda? And because of the compatibility relations are the same among the sources as they were among the measurements, the possibilities for these kinds of inferences are exactly the same as for these. They both admit only these indeterministic assignments. So for example, I could have that indeterministic set of expectation values I showed you earlier as what I predict for the outcomes of all the measurements, but also what I retrodict for the outcomes of all the sources for a given ontic state lambda between them. All right, so suppose that's the case. I have this ontic state. I want to know what kinds of correlations can I get between these measurement devices and these sources. And what I'm going to look at are the cases where it's matched, the same color measurement as source. So I'm going to be interested in particular in this quantity, just the product of the outcomes of the two summed over all 9 possibilities, 9 pairings. Okay, so I can plug in an expression for that operational quantity, which is, I know what the probabilities are, so I can plug it in. And it just boils down to saying, figure out what the correlation looks like for a particular ontic state. So that's just the product of the expectation values for that ontic state times the distribution over the ontic states. So what it basically says is in the ontological model, you just need to say how well correlated could these 9 pairs be, and then figure out what the maximum possible average of those guys could be. So I showed you an example here of a very particular prediction and retrodiction from an ontic state. But it happens to be the ones that gives you the strongest possible correlation. You can figure out what the extreme points of this polytope of assignments are, and you'll find that none give stronger correlations than this one. And it's just, perfect correlation for 5 of the choices, like the green, the light green, the yellow, the orange, and the blue. And then no correlation for, the red and the pink and the light blue and this guy here. So it's 5/9 of the time you get perfect correlation. So the correlation for that lambda is 5/9. But like I said, no other lambda does any better, so the overall correlation has to be less than or equal to 5/9. That's the non-contextuality inequality. Okay, and now, notice that quantum theory violates this inequality, because if I do the quantum sources and the quantum measurements, I'm just preparing one of 2 eigenspaces and then measuring whether I'm in one or another eigenspace. And so obviously I'm going to get perfect correlation for every one of the 9, so it's going to be 1. But the important thing is that even if the quantum realization is not sharp, even if these are POVMs rather than projective measurements, that's just going to degrade the correlation. But I've got lots of room to degrade that correlation before it gets below 5/9. So this is, in fact, quite highly noise robust. So I need contextuality to explain it for anything above 5/9. Okay, if you want to hear more about that, see Ravi's talk. The 2 other problems, inexact operational equivalences. Remember, that was the fact that no 2 preparations ever give exactly the same statistics for all measurements. So this was solved in these 2 papers. Here's the idea. I'll give you just a quantum example. Suppose you had an experiment that required you to do 3 different sources. So one has basically this preparation with equal probability, another is this or this with equal probability, and another is this or this with equal probability. So just, three different sources that all mix to the complete mixed state. So you go to the lab, you do your best to implement those 6 preparations, but what you actually achieve is these 6 quantum states. And then you notice that the equal mixture of these 2 guys is this point, the equal mixture of these 2 guys is this point, the equal mixture of these 2 guys is this point, and they don't line up. And no matter how hard you try, you never get them to quite line up, so you never see the strict equivalence that you need. So the solution is to realize that when you've done these 6 preparations in the lab, you've also figured out how to characterize an infinite number of preparation procedures. Any preparation procedure that's a convex mixture of these 6 is something for which you can now predict the statistics of all measurements. Right? You don't need to go to the lab and flip a coin and do this or this. You know what statistics you would get if you did this one half the time, this one half the time. It's the statistics associated with this point. So you know what all those preparations look like, and you know that they exist in your theory, that the world allows for those preparation procedures. So you can just say, all right, let me then find numerically 6 preparation procedures that have the operational equivalences I want exactly. So it's a constraint on my fit now. Just find 6 of them. Ideally, they approximate the ones I wanted to achieve as best I can, but they now satisfy this constraint exactly. And in the worst case, if you've done really poorly, these 6 might be close to identity and therefore highly noisy, but that just means you have less chance of violating the inequality at the end of the day. But you do have the left-hand side of the non-contextuality inference satisfied. Okay, the third problem is, it's similar for the measurements. You can do something similar. You can do it for generalized probabilistic theories rather than quantum theory. But you've got the basic idea of the trick now. You take these new procedures that you've defined from your fit, you plug those into the inequality, not the statistics for the original procedures, but for the ones that you found through your fit. Because they're the ones that you expect to apply the assumption of non-contextuality to. Okay, so the final problem was this universal quantifier business. We can never do all measurements, for example, so what do we do? And the answer is, we look at a tomographically complete set of measurements instead. So the definition of tomographic completeness, say for a set of measurements, is a smaller set of measurements, not the full set, which by definition is sufficient to predict the statistics for all the other measurements. So it's basically, by definition, tomographic completeness means something that would imply an equality for all measurements, even though the equality is only given for a finite set of measurements. Okay, so we need to figure out what tomographically complete sets are. In quantum theory, we know what the tomographically complete set of measurements for a single qubit are. An example would just be measuring X poly, Y poly, and Z poly. If you give me the outcomes of those three measurements, I know where I am in the block sphere, the block ball, and now I can predict the statistics for any other measurement. So I didn't need to do measurements along every direction of the block sphere. These three sufficed to predict the statistics of all the rest. Of course, we don't want to assume the validity of quantum theory if we want to do a direct experimental test of non-contextuality. So we can't just say, oh, it's going to be enough to do some, you know, three measurements that are like the quantum ones. But what we can do is experimentally try to find tomographically complete sets. So we could take a subset and say, is it the case that from the statistics for this subset, one can infer the statistics for every other measurement? And suppose you find such a subset, and then you try to prove that it's not right. So you add more measurements to the mix, and you say, can I still predict the statistics of all these measurements? And you can. And then you add more, and you say, I'm going to try to prove that this set is not tomographically complete. And you fail, and you fail. And then you get more and more evidence that what you're looking at is indeed a tomographically complete set of measurements. And similarly, if I want to find a tomographically complete set of preparations, I can do the same thing. I can test the hypothesis experimentally that a given set of preparations is tomographically complete, or a given cardinality of a set of preparations is sufficient for tomographic completeness. So if you want to hear more about how that's done, so Mike Masaryk's talk on Friday will describe an experiment that really tries to push hard on this test of tomographic completeness. And so essentially, we've got something like 1,000 measurements, and we can show that 4 effects are sufficient to predict the statistics of the other 996 effects that we've measured. And that gives you some evidence for Mike will talk more about, you know, how strong the evidence is, but it gives a certain confidence that you know, for the polarization degree of a single photon, you have good evidence that the set of measurements you are looking at is tomographically complete. But there is a subtlety here, which is that in principle, you can never strictly verify the claim that a given set of procedures is tomographically complete, because you know, you could always find a new measurement tomorrow that actually its statistics is not predicted by the ones that you already had. It would be perhaps a great discovery. Quantum theory is wrong. You know, the tomographically complete set is not what we thought. But you can accumulate more and more evidence by trying hard to falsify the claim and failing to falsify that claim. And so assumptions of tomographic completeness are always tentative. And that's, I think, the correct attitude to take, that this is something that you have to develop evidence for, and it's tentative evidence. Okay, so in the last couple of minutes, I think I have a couple of minutes, or maybe not. Yeah, you can do that. All right. Why is this notion of non-contextuality, I've described very rapidly, natural? So in my view, it's natural because it's a special instance of Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles. So this is a methodological principle for the construction of physical theories. And the idea is, it says the following, that if a physical model posits that there exist two scenarios that are empirically completely indistinguishable, even in principle, so by the lights of the theory, there's nothing that, you know, agents in the world could do to distinguish these two scenarios. But nonetheless, it represents those scenarios as ontologically distinct, then the model should be rejected, and it should be replaced with a model that makes those two scenarios ontologically the same. Okay? So that's the idea. It's the ontological identity of empirical indiscernibles. And I think it has really impeccable credentials. Here's an example. At the birth of special relativity, in Einstein's 1905 paper, he made an argument against ether theories by saying, look, if I imagine a magnet at rest with respect to the ether and a coil moving with respect to the ether, I get a certain induction in the coil, a current, and a certain picture of what the fields are and how that happens. Whereas if the coil is at rest with respect to the ether and the magnet moves through it, I get exactly the same induced current, but a completely different picture of how that's happening. And so Einstein says, it doesn't make sense that there's two ontological pictures that are completely indiscernible in terms of their effects. We must replace this ether theory with a model of reality that says only the relative motions are important and explains these two scenarios in exactly the same way. And that gives us special relativity. General relativity, Einstein does the same trick with the strong equivalence principle. He says, look, empirically, there's nothing you can do to distinguish whether you're at rest in a gravitational field or accelerating uniformly through free space. Therefore, we should try to make a model that posits an ontology that says it's because these are ontologically exactly the same situation. And that's what curved space-time does for you. It achieves the same explanation of dynamics in those two instances. And then finally, to really get to general relativity, he had to figure out general covariance, and the key conceptual step was something called the Hole argument, where Einstein realized that the empirical phenomena outside some given region don't change at all if you do diffeomorphism within that region. So he concludes diffeomorphisms cannot be ontologically real transformations, and we must make everything diffeomorphism invariant. So, you know, two of the pillars of modern physics, all coming from Leibniz's principle. Bell's notion of local causality is another example. So if you have a violation of Bell's notion of causality, you imagine that your setting over on the left could have a causal influence of the system B moving to the right. And yet, no measurement you do on B, no matter what you do on B, will have any information about what the setting over here is, space-like separated. So you'd be saying, oh, there's some difference in the physical properties of B in this model that fails to satisfy local causality, and yet nothing you do over here could reveal anything about those properties. Clear violation of Leibniz. Bell's notion of local causality satisfies Leibniz. And then finally, if you go to statistics and the field of causal inference, what you find is that there's a number of principles they use there, one called the no fine-tuning principle, other principles of statistical modeling, which basically look to have no overfitting. And I think these two can be thought of as instances of Leibniz's principle. So to my mind, it's strange that in physics, given the role of this methodological principle in special relativity and general relativity, we don't really hear about it. It's to my mind, one of the most successful methodological principles that we've seen in physics, right? And so we should be celebrating Leibniz's principle, and we never hear about it. But clearly, non-classicality is an example of this, right? I mean, non-contextuality is an instance of Leibniz's principle. And therefore, you know, I've tried to equate non-classicality with the failure to admit of a non-contextual ontological model. So I'm really equating non-classicality with a failure to satisfy Leibniz's principle. And so, okay, the final question is, what do we do about the fact that quantum theory and what our experiments tell us is true of nature, they both fail to admit of a non-contextual model, so they fail to admit of a model that satisfies this Leibnizian principle. What should we do? Do we abandon Leibniz's principle? I've tried to argue no. I mean, this is just such a powerful methodological principle. We should hold on to it because, you know, that's sort of what history has taught us. Maybe we should give up on realism and say this whole idea of a notion of an ontological model is misguided, so we should just be operationalists. And I want to say, no, that's philosophically probably not the best option. I think there's a third path, which is to try to define a notion of realism that goes beyond the ontological model's framework and manages to salvage Leibniz's principle. And therefore, it salvages also the spirit of locality and the spirit of non-contextuality. The idea that, you know, empirical indistinguishability means sameness of the ontological representation. So the idea is that this ontological model framework that we've been using is not inevitable. It's not like a commitment to realism forces you to adopt that framework. And so in particular, one way to think about ontological models is a version of a causal model. So in this field of causal inference, which is a subfield of machine learning, people talk about modeling experiments by causal structures. And they write down sort of the causal relation between variables. So this would be the variables pertaining to a prepare and measure experiment. This is the kind of causal relations you'd write down. And that specifies what sorts of conditional probabilities you need. I need to specify what the conditional probability of y given t and lambda are, what the conditional probability of x and lambda given s are. And because, you know, if we're committed to Leibniz, no measurement on system A reveals any information about S, it better be the case that the distribution over lambda doesn't depend on S at all. So that's the non-contextuality. And then, you know, working out the correlations between the outcomes of the source and the measurement, that's what gives my the non-contextuality inequalities. So this is another way of phrasing what we've assumed. And rather than saying it was this inference of Leibniz that was at stake, you could say, well, we're using the framework of classical probability theory. There's a commitment here about what the right mathematical formalism for modeling our incomplete information should be. This causal mediary here is something that we don't have direct access to. It's what's called in this community a latent variable. It's something that happens, you know, between two things that we do have direct access to. And so there's this idea that we should represent our, you know, knowledge of that thing. You know, it has some particular value, it's represented by a classical variable, and our knowledge of it is represented by a probability distribution, and here's how we should update that probability distribution, and so on. And so the idea is that maybe it's the classical probability theory that was the problem, and we need to update our theory of how we make inferences under incomplete information. So in these pair of papers, for example, there's an idea described wherein you replace conditional probabilities by what we call conditional states. In the paper with Matt Liefer. And you can maintain Leibniz's principle because these conditional states now respect the non-contextuality, right? The fact that no measurement on A reveals any information about S tells you that the conditional state A given S should just be the same as the marginal state on A. But there's a much more general calculus which is meant to mirror the calculus of Bayesian inference, but to be a generalization of it. And so there'd be a lot to say about this topic, but you can recover exactly the violations of the non-contextuality inequalities we see in quantum theory using this kind of framework. What we can't do at present is have a framework that allows you to do Bayesian inference for any causal structure. So if I just gave you some complicated causal structure and said, you know the values of outcomes of measurements on all these guys, and you want to make inferences about all these other guys that are distributed in some arbitrary way, we don't have a formalism yet that allows us to do that generally. But I think it looks hopeful that we could build such a formalism. And therefore, it seems to me that at the end of the day, our future, if this works as a possible interpretation of quantum theory, it would really salvage the notion of non-contextuality. And it would say non-classicality is not about failing to be non-contextual. It's non-contextual. It's about inference failing to be classical. It's about classical probability theory changing into something different. But Leibniz and non-contextuality being principles that are still upheld. So, thanks for your attention.
Questions for Rob? Is there anything here?
Very nice talk. You're emphasizing the Leibniz principle.
Yeah.
It bothers me a bit that, I don't think it's quite that, because, if you go right back to your original definitions, it's a mathematical triviality that you can cook up some ontological theory that will recover these equivalences. And if one looks in detail at the results, things like preparation, contextuality, additional assumptions come in. So typically you assume that the states have preparations rather have a convex structure, and also the ontological variable, and that moreover, and crucially, that this convex structure is preserved in passing from the ontological variable to the operational. And I think that was also, that also plays a role in the derivation of the non-contextuality inequalities. So, to fully assess the plausibility, I think there's more to it than Leibniz's principle, which I agree with you is very hard to argue against.
So I disagree with you that there's a substantive extra assumption that I need to get that convex structure. I believe that that's a consequence of the commitment to classical probability theory. So when I say here's an ontological model, part of that is a commitment to the idea that, we describe our lack of information by classical probability theory. And then I would describe it this way. If I've got, a big preparation procedure which, implements one or another preparation procedure at random, right? So there's some coin flip here. And then it's either this one or this one. Let's say it's a half-a-half coin flip, or a W, one minus W. So I call this whole thing preparation P. It spits out, it samples an ontic state. So say you tell me what the distribution of our ontic states for P1 is, and what the distribution of our ontic states for P2 is. Okay, so that's given. So then the question is, if I'm committed to classical probability, what distribution of ontic states must I assign to the situation where I know the preparation procedure is P? Classical probability theory tells me to reason as follows. What I believe about lambda is that it's distributed as mu of lambda given P1, if P1 was implemented, times the probability that P1 was implemented. So for a particular lambda, I can say, what's the probability that's the lambda that comes out? It's the probability that it comes out of P1 times the probability P1 was implemented, plus the probability that that lambda comes out if P2 is implemented, times the probability P2 is implemented. So it's just W times mu lambda P1 plus 1 minus W mu lambda given P2. That's just classical probability theory. So I don't think that, and because the ontological models framework presumes the correctness of classical probability theory, I don't consider it an additional assumption.
Well, it's an additional assumption mathematically because you can't prove anything without it. So it's an assumption that has considerable consequences.
But I'm using lots of assumptions from classical probability theory. Why pick this one out?
Well,
I also use the law of total probability. I mean, I could list for you all the assumptions of classical probability theory, but it's just, in my approach, subsumed under the definition of ontological models, as every other law of classical probability theory is.
Okay, so it may be that the notion, as you say, the notion of ontological model is quite a loaded one, in the sense that...
Right. It is, and what I was pointing out at the end is that, to my mind, it's the problem. If we want a good interpretation of quantum theory, it's not the non-contextuality that was problematic, to my view. It's the framework of ontological models. It's the notion that you must understand realism as there are these hidden variables that have values and your knowledge of them is represented by classical probability theory. So I agree with you that I think that's where the problem lies. But we need a kind of a systematic approach to how you would generalize classical probability theory. I want to think of it as quantifying subjective degrees of belief, as a theory of inference. And so I want to lay down axioms for what any kind of generalization of a theory of inference could possibly be. And I think, you know, that's the interesting project. So I think we're in agreement as to its unnaturalness. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So I wanted to ask about you're saying we don't need to give up realism. This is one way that we can preserve realism.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of ontological models, I feel like I have a fairly good sense of what realism is because we're still talking about electrons and their properties. We're moving to something like causal models. I feel like the subject matter is maybe changing. It sounds like we're talking now about events and there are a lot between events.
Yep.
Is this accurate? Can we still maintain talk of electrons in this framework, or how does that work?
Well, because I don't have a final answer, I can't say exactly what a pared down notion of realism would really look like. But I can give you a kind of flavor of it. That, to my mind, when you look at things like Simpson's paradox, which show you that correlations could be due to a common cause or a cause-effect relation, and if you want to know whether a drug's effective for some illness or not, you better sort out whether the correlation was spurious or whether it was really cause-effect. There's something called Reichenbach's principle that says every correlation you see in nature should be explained causally somehow, either by a common cause or cause-effect relation. And to my mind, that's a very useful notion of realism, that there are no bare correlations. The correlations are all explained causally. So you could take that as your notion of realism. I would say I have a realist model. If I cannot just explain to you what the correlations in a given experiment is, but give you a causal account of them. So for example, if we look at Bell correlations, for example, I can give you an account of why it is that learning about X on the left teaches you about Y on the right in the following sense. It's like this. Well, there's a common cause, and do it over here. Learning about X has taught me something about the common cause, and therefore that common cause has taught me something about Y, and that is why there's this correlation. That's why I can make inferences between X and Y. So there are no bare inferences. Inferences always go through the underlying causal structure. Now, is that causal structure going to be just describing events or something else? It's not clear. But the idea is that maybe we can get away with a realism that just explains correlations causally, but doesn't do it using kind of the paradigm of kinematics and dynamics that we're accustomed to.
Yes. So I wanted to make a comment about the measurement non-contextual model of Barrett's neuron, which you have.
Okay.
So it seems to me that there's something more going on here than that you've simply dropped the notion of outcome determinism. So in particular, I think the fact that you get this model is due to your notion of compatibility of measurements.
Mm-hmm.
So your notion of compatibility is that you can obtain two measurements are compatible, you can obtain both of them by coarse grading from some other measurements. I mean, you could take a different notion of compatibility, which would be that behavior is factorized.
Say again?
That their behavior is factorized. This would be a different notion of compatibility.
That they factorize, you said?
Yes.
Like the observable on a composite system factorizes, do you mean? Or?
I mean, if you want to represent it quantum mechanically, you might say that the POVMs for these things commute, for instance. But within the theory, it might not within your ontological theory, it might not necessarily be the coarse graining notion. Factorizability.
Okay.
In which case you would not be able to use this model, because what you have left over, the outcome non-deterministic part, it essentially looks like a PR box, right? And so we know that we cannot obtain this from factorizable in variables.
I don't think I understood the second part of your question, but let me see if I can address the first part. It is true that you could have a different notion of compatibility, even while subscribing to my notion of operational equivalence. You could say, for example, you know, if I do measurement M1 and then measurement M2, or I do measurement M2 and then M1, and I demand that the statistics of M1 is the same in these two cases, then I could say, for all preparation procedures, it doesn't matter what order I choose, then I say M1 and M2 are compatible. And so I could, for example, say, oh, these three guys on top are compatible if I can really measure them. I can find some way of measuring them that it doesn't matter what order I measure them in. Okay. Now, the reason I prefer this notion of compatibility to that one is, let's take the quantum example. You know, if things are projective, then they coincide. This joint simulatability notion and this invariance under reordering notion are exactly the same as long as I use the von Neumann-Luders rule. But when I move to POVMs, typically this invariance under reordering just goes out the window. Like even a given POVM might not be invariant under reordering with itself, right? I could get different statistics the second time I measure the POVM. So it's not even compatible with itself relative to that notion. But of course, relative to the joint simulatability notion, it's compatible with itself because it simulates itself. And so because I'm focused on trying to get a notion for unsharp measurements, for POVMs, it makes sense to use this notion. And let me say one other thing, which is that all this notion commits you to is a characterization of your measurement as a POVM. I don't need to tell you what quantum instrument models it. I don't need to tell you what the state update rule looks like. But here, I need to talk about the state update rule. And furthermore, I need to say something about the ontological model of this as a transformation rather than just as a retrodiction. So this is nice because it doesn't even care about the transformative aspect of the measurement. It's just about the retrodictive aspect of the experiment. And that seems right to me, given that, you know, I can just do a prepare and measure experiment. That's all I've talked about here. There might be proofs of contextuality that involve prepare, transform, measure, and then the transformation aspect becomes important. But strictly speaking, I think, you know, we've only got these alternative measurements. It doesn't matter how they're transforming the system. So I think this joint simulatability notion is preferable for those reasons.
So, I mean, you may have a preference for this, but I think it's just worth making explicit that it does appear to be doing some work for you. So perhaps it's related to Samson's point. I mean, it is some sort of assumption that is necessary here. And if you take this other notion, I know that you can not get a non-contextual model for me. You can't, your non-contextual model doesn't fold under this other notion.
Okay.
So I think it's just worth making explicit that would be my comment. That this is the notion of compatibility that's going in.
Yes.
And I think it does some work for you.
Well, let me say this. This morning I had four extra slides on the difference between these two notions of compatibility. And I thought, you know, I'm going to be speaking so fast already. We've got to cut them out. So, but thanks for giving me the chance to clarify the point.
I think people are.
Yeah.
thank Rob and.